Welcome to Piedmont Arts. I'm Rachel Stewart.
I had a kind of unusual way of coming at classical music because I came to love 20th century music, more modern classical music, earlier than liking older music like Mozart and so forth.
Philip Bush is a pianist and Charlotte native. He's the performer for WDAV's next small batch concert coming up Thursday, May 28th at Free Range Brewing. And we'll get to know him a little bit and hear about how being in Charlotte influenced his musical development. Well, with Memorial Day almost here, you may be looking for things to do during your long holiday weekend. Phil Vavra, as always, has a ton of suggestions. There's a lot going on this coming weekend, and that'll be in his fanfare segment. It's coming up a little bit later on in the program. Pianist Philip Bush grew up in Charlotte, and maybe one of the most accomplished classical musicians to come out of the Queen City. He studied at the Peabody Conservatory with Leon Fleischer and launched his career by winning the American Pianist Association Fellowship Award, and his New York recital debut was at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in 1984. He made his Carnegie Hall debut with the London Sinfonietta when he was a last-minute substitute for the ailing Peter Serkin. He's performed around the world as a recitalist, orchestral soloist, and chamber musician, and currently he's professor of piano and chamber music at the University of South Carolina School of Music. Very soon, on May 28th, he'll perform at WDAV's Small Batch Concert at Free Range Brewing, so we thought it would be nice to get to know him a little bit before that happens. So, Philip, it is great to have you on Piedmont Arts.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Well, why don't we start near the beginning? Is Charlotte where you started studying the piano?
Pretty much. I mean, I was pretty close to a beginner when we moved to Charlotte when I was entering first grade.
So who did you study with in Charlotte?
So I studied for really the entire time with an incredible teacher, the late John Whitaker, he founded Southern Park Music School, which for many, many years was on Selwyn Avenue. John Whitaker was my teacher basically from, almost, I think, second or third grade, all the way to the time I left to go to study with Leon Fleischer at Peabody. So he took me an enormous distance, really, the whole distance from, near beginning to conservatory level. And he was a wonderful, wonderful teacher and just the right person for me, all the years that I was, going through typical teenage angst and stuff like that. He negotiated those passages with me very adeptly, and he was just an incredible teacher and wonderful human being, and I owe so much of my musical development to his tutelage and to his at the foundational stages of development of piano technique and musicality.
Yeah, I don't know if it's very common for people to have a teacher for that long, to take him through all those stages.
Yeah, I've met many great teachers around the country who just their lives are devoted to working with pre-college kids in their community. And he of course has been a great teacher for many other pianists. And it's they're not as well known nationally perhaps as other teachers, but they form the backbone of musical life for a lot of the country. And so he was just a great teacher. I'm lucky that we found him, it's when right away near the beginning of the time we moved to Charlotte.
You said he helped you negotiate teenage angst. Did you ever have a time when you just wanted to stop playing piano?
I didn't want to stop playing piano. I didn't really always like the idea of practicing, I had a lot of other interests, I wasn't like somebody who was like, super 100% focused on playing piano every hour that I was on in school. It wasn't that kind of life for me at all. Also, the other thing that John Whitaker did for me that he saw very early on that I was interested in, I had a kind of unusual way of coming at classical music because I came to love 20th century music, more modern classical music, earlier than liking older music like Mozart and so forth. I liked music that was very rhythmic, had sort of a rhythmic foundation. So I got really excited and intrigued by the 20th century composers like Prokofiev and Shostakovich and so forth. So he gave me music like sort of at first pedagogical, short pieces by composers to kind of whet my appetite to do things like unusual time signatures and unusual sonorities and even like doing things inside the piano, that kind of thing. And that, of course, really continued in my life, that interest in contemporary music. He saw that that was something I really liked, and he fed that interest a lot, you know. But at the same time, you know, I worked my way backwards in chronology to love Chopin and Beethoven and Mozart and Bach and so forth.
Speaking of contemporary music, I see the Frank Zappa poster on the back of your
Oh
wall,
yeah,
on your
sorry.
back wall.
That's right. That's scary. Yeah, that was a present from a doctoral student when she finished school here, and I decided to go ahead and put it there and kind of freak out potential students coming in to audition for me.
Well, maybe we'll come back to talking about contemporary music in a minute, but after Charlotte, you went to Peabody and you studied with Leon Fleisher, who I was fortunate enough to interview one time in his later years. And he was one of the best interviews, most fun people I ever talked to.
Oh, yeah.
So, what was it like studying with him?
It was incredible experience. I was sort of among the first crop of sort of undergraduate students that he'd taken. I was only 17 when I started with him, and it was kind of like a, you know, like what's the saying, drinking from a fire hose kind of thing. It was like just an incredible tidal wave of information and inspiration coming at me. Again, I was just kind of developing a kind of a better methodology of work habits and so forth, and practice habits. And I feel like a lot of things that he taught me, I was able to implement them more later. I sort of, they were in my notes and they were in my mind, and in many years, I mean, in all the years since, really, I keep going back mentally to things he said. I still hear his voice sort of talking to me about this or that passage, even if it's not a piece that we directly worked on, but the ideas that he espoused and emphasized. Yeah, no, it was very inspirational. It was a very dramatic time too, because to be in his studio, because this was just at the time when he was starting to, as you know, he lost the use of his for playing anyway, of his right hand, for quite a number of years. And it was just the point where he had gone through, had some surgery in Boston, and made his first sort of quasi comeback, where he played with two hands with the Baltimore Symphony. It was very dramatic, and he was, and there were times when he would get inspired in a lesson, and the basic default position was that he would sit at the piano at my right side, and all these difficult right hand passages that I would play, you know, he would be showing me how, you know, demonstrating how he thought I might want to have them go, and he would be doing all that with his left hand, which is, of course, completely inverse. Not Your left hand is not designed to play right hand passages. So, but he was so incredibly virtuosic that it would be always scintillating.
So, when did he get the use of that right hand back where he was satisfied that he could play?
It happened a little bit more in the late 80s, late 80s and early 90s. Of course, he had sort of, he chose repertoire carefully, and chamber music a lot, and some limited solo works, because of course he hadn't, you know, essentially been practicing with that hand for more or less for by that point it was 25, 30 years almost, yeah.
Yeah, his story is really remarkable. So
Absolutely.
yeah, I know that you're a professor of chamber music and piano, and I know chamber music is something that you really enjoy. And I know also a lot of your peers consider you a go-to pianist for chamber music. Did you think you were going to devote a lot of your career to chamber music, or did you just decide this is the best? I love this.
I guess I had little doses of it early on, even when I was still in high school. And then at Peabody, you know, we had to do a certain amount of collaborative work as part of our scholarship sort of duties, and I kind of enjoyed that and got more into that. I had Frontmen, you know, my friends, like my roommates were, I seemed to know a lot of clarinet players, so I played a lot of clarinet repertoire, and then, yeah, and then some formed a piano trio with fellow students there. And it was also, I think, the messaging from my teacher, from Leon Fleisher, was that you know, the value of chamber music. I mean, he regarded it on a level, the repertoire, equally as high as the best solo music. And it's often said, you know, it's kind of a model for, I don't know about democracy, but a model for sort of coming together decisions by consensus, because it's no, the interpretation is never 100% one person's idea. It's obviously an amalgamation of everybody's input and so forth. So it's yeah, so there's that sort of satisfying feeling of ownership of the final product as well.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about your love of contemporary music, which sounds like you just said it started very early on when you were still studying here in Charlotte. What is it about the contemporary music that got your attention?
Well, I think, I think I alluded to it before, to the there's in a lot of 20th century music. And of course, when I was a kid, it was the 20th century in the and I was always drawn to sort of rhythmic music. Like I listened to a lot of pop and rock, and so I guess, and it was, I can pinpoint this very specific event. The New York Philharmonic came to Charlotte, to Ovens Auditorium, I think in 1972. I was 11 years old, and they played Concerto for Orchestra by Béla Bartók. Bartók, of course, very interesting, kind of odd meters, unusual time signatures, and just interesting sonorities, a lot of percussion involved and so forth. And I just remember listening to that music and some other, 20th century orchestral works maybe, and thinking, oh wow, classical music can have a groove.
Well, you have performed with the Philip Glass Ensemble, right? And Steve Reich and musicians.
Yeah, those were both, in both cases, those were, they were both of them kind of in the vanguard of a trend that continued a little bit later with of composers, because they were, it was not coming out of the sort of traditional conservatory or the normal channels. They came up playing, in the late 1960s and early 70s in galleries in Lower Manhattan and so forth. And in each case, they just sort of formed an ensemble specifically to perform and promote their own music. In each of their cases, of course, then as their music gained wider acclaim, the ensembles began to tour more widely. That came out of, and actually that came out of, I mean, both cases, one directly, one indirectly, out of my 2 years studying at the Banff Center in Canada, because they would have a rotating array of guest artists come in, to big performers that you could study with, take lessons with. They'd be around for a week or 2 weeks. Steve Reich was a guest there in March of 1983. And the students, in preparation for that, we all learned some different ensemble works of Steve's. And I organized kind of a performance of his work called Six Pianos, which has six pianos. And then I hung out with Steve Reich for like the whole week, like a leech attached to him. Because I'd already was such a fan of his music. And so he said, and I was about to move to New York after that. And he said, well, just, when you get settled, let me know, give me your contact info. And he started using me for kind of rehearsals and things like that. And then eventually in pieces of his, like Music for 18 Musicians, big famous minimalist kind of landmark work, he brought me into the ensemble. And I, it's from 1986, I think, just about, yeah, like 40 years ago. I think this June would be the 40th anniversary of my playing that piece with that group. And then, word got around. It was like the among the minimalist community, I guess you could say, of New York City. Oh, this guy can play this music and keep his wits about him. And so then I got called from Philip Glass's people, and I got involved with his ensemble and started touring, doing projects with them the next year, I think in 1987. So.
Well, that's a good transition in a way to talking about some of the music you're going to play at Small Batch, 'cause I believe you have a Philip Glass piece
I
on there.
am going to play Philip Glass.
And I don't know everything that's on your program. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what the highlights might be?
I've thought about sort of bracketing it with like kind of more quote unquote standard classical, works. It's kind of, I guess, maybe a little bit of a snapshot of some of the different kinds of music that intrigue me, or that I like to explore, or that have been significant in my own life. And so I guess I kind of bracketed it with Beethoven on one end and Chopin on the other. I'm probably going to start with a, in fact, I am going to start with a fun Beethoven piece called the Polonaise that he wrote to celebrate the Congress of Vienna in 1815, a kind of a fun fanfare type piece that's jollier than what we usually think of Beethoven. And then going to play the famous Moonlight Sonata. I love that work. And then towards the end of the concert, the other sort of quote unquote standard classical work I'm going to play is the Scherzo in C sharp minor by Frédéric Chopin. But in between, there are going to be other works. There, Philip Glass, I'm going to play a work of his from around 1979, 1980 called Mad Rush. That's kind of in his vintage minimalist style, you know, very beautiful, actually. Again, basically just founded around some very simple harmonic progression, but just the textures change in sort of different sections of it. I think that's very representative of Philip's music, especially that period, the 1980. But then also little forays into jazz and jazz-like things. I'm not really a jazz pianist, but I love to play transcriptions. You know, many people out there have done these transcriptions where they've taken recordings of great jazz pianists and basically notated what they did. And then it allows wannabe jazzers like me, classical pianists, to sort of try to like put on the clothes of Duke Ellington or different people. And so there's a couple of tunes by Duke Ellington. And then I'm also going to play another completely other end of jazz, a more recent or later than that period of jazz. I've always been a fan of the jazz guitarist Pat Metheny and his longtime pianist who just passed away 2 or 3 years ago, Lyle Mays. Do a piece of theirs from I'm thinking 1980 album pieces titled September 15th, which is a tribute to Bill Evans, who had passed away on September 15th, 1980. So they did this piece, which is very beautiful, very almost at times impressionistic kind of. Lyle Mays was it's a great jazz player, but his touch was just almost at times reminded you of like Ravel, the best Ravel playing, that kind of thing. Yeah, and then I'm going to finish with the solo transcription from that guy over my head, Frank Zappa. I've been one of his, just a 4 minute kind of snippet from his Roxy and Elsewhere album from like 1973 recordings. I'm doing a piece called Echidna's Arf. Echidna, that marsupial in Australia, I think, with spiny, with little spines. Anyway, it's just a 4 minute thing with lots of meter changes. And so I'm still working on there's some people who've done transcriptions, and I'm kind of taking different parts of this transcription and that transcription and kind of adding my own kind of arrangement to make it more difficult. I don't know why. Just sort of more, try to capture more of the feeling of the tune. So, so that'd probably be the end of the concert, would be the Zappa. So yeah, it's pretty, I think it will cover a pretty wide range and be kind of representative of my musical restlessness, I guess you could say.
Pianist Philip Bush performs at WDAV's Small Batch Concert at Free Range Brewing on Thursday, May 28th. You can find all the details at wdav.org/smallbatch. Memorial Day weekend is just about here, and if you don't have any plans, Phil Vavra's got some good ideas for you. Phil?
Thank you, Rachel. The unofficial start of summer usually means there'll be traffic. This weekend, families will be headed to pools, lakes, and beaches in droves. Another few dozen drivers will be making multiple left turns at Charlotte Motor Speedway, but if you're willing to brave a bit of the bumper-to-bumper, you'll be rewarded with some truly entertaining experiences this Memorial Day weekend. Let's start with a trip to South Carolina's Lowcountry. Every year, the Spoleto Festival USA fills Charleston's historic theaters, churches, and outdoor spaces with orchestral, chamber, choral, opera, dance, jazz, contemporary music, theater performances, and talks. This year's event runs for 17 days from May 22nd through June 7th and will feature renowned artists and emerging performers. Highlights include Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 5, Mozart's Mass in C minor, Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 1, the U.S. premiere of Scottish Ballet's Mary Queen of Scots, and a Martha Graham Dance Company celebration. The kid-centric Piccolo Spoleto Festival runs concurrently. The Little Theater of Gastonia is presenting a stage adaptation of Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None, May 22nd through 31st. The story is about 10 strangers trapped on an island off the coast of England. Each is accused of past crimes that went unpunished by the law. As they turn up dead, one at a time, the remaining guests deduce that the murderer is one of their own. Can you dig it? Yes, you can, as the North Carolina Fossil Festival returns to the Aurora Fossil Museum in Aurora, North Carolina, May 23rd and 24th. This family-friendly celebration of the state's rich fossil record includes fossil displays, a dinosaur show, live entertainment, food and craft vendors, silent auction, and an opportunity to dig for fossils yourself. Admission is free with some ticketed activities. Discovery Place Science in Uptown Charlotte is hosting Brickmaster Studio, Build with Lego Bricks Like a Pro, May 23rd through September 7th. This immersive exhibition by acclaimed Lego artist Sean Kinney features more than 100 of his sculptures built with over 2 million pieces. It's also a hands-on experience that allows visitors to explore their own artistic and engineering talents. The exhibition is included with your museum admission. Just don't walk around without your shoes on. Winston-Salem Symphony violinist Ava Gondek and guitarist Wiley Porter are bringing the Great American Songbook to the Mary Alice Warren Community Center in Louisville for a free afternoon concert on Saturday, May 24th at 3 p.m. The duo's program will include popular standards by George Gershwin, Cole Porter, Jerome Kern, and many more. Blumenthal Arts is bringing the Belle Epoque to the Queen City. Winner of 10 Tony Awards, including Best Musical, Moulin Rouge the Musical comes to the Belk Theater May 26th through 31st. The elaborate stage production follows the plot of Baz Luhrmann's romantic 2001 film with its lavish costumes and pop soundtrack that blends classic and modern hits. Bach Charlotte's annual Charlotte Bach Festival gets underway with Bach and Brahms from Counterpoint to Power, a free performance at Free Range Brewing in Noda, Wednesday, May 27th at 3 p.m. Cellist Guy Fishman and pianist Esther Jihe-An will make the musical connection from the Baroque to Romantic era with works including Brahms's Cello Sonata in E minor. The festival continues through June 7th with performances of Vivaldi's Gloria, choruses from Handel's Messiah, Purcell's Dido and Aeneas, Handel's Theodora, and works by Johann Sebastian Bach at venues across the Charlotte area. And you may want to add some additional stops when you see what else is on my complete fanfare column. So buckle up, drive safely, and have fun. Fanfare is made possible in part by Bragg Financial. Rachel?
Thanks, Phil. That's it for this week's Piedmont Arts. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast to get all the new episodes so you can stay up to date with cultural happenings in our region. You can do that at wdav.org/podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and iHeart Podcast. I'm Rachel Stewart.